This meeting of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee will come to order at 1:33 p.m. We are in the Belts Room 105. Today is Monday, January 30th, 2023. Members of the committee present today are Senator Merrick, Senator Bishop, Senator Gray Jackson, Senator Dunbar, and myself, Senator Bjorkman. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to do business. Please silence or turn off your cell phones. I'd like to thank Recording Secretary Juliana Singh and LAO Moderator Jake Ward for being here with us today. Welcome everyone to Senate Labor and Commerce. Today we will continue our exploration of workforce issues in Alaska. With us via Teams this afternoon, we have Lori Wolf, President and CEO of the Foraker Group. Lori is here to describe the workforce challenges she is seeing within the nonprofit arena. A little background on the Foraker Group. They are a 501c3 organization whose core purpose is to strengthen nonprofits. Their deep commitment to advancing dedicated, skilled, and compassionate professionals and volunteers to serve Alaska's nonprofit and tribal organizations is guided by the Foraker Nonprofit Sustainability Model. Founded in 1998, the United Way of Anchorage set a strategic goal to create a model of shared services for the nonprofit sector based on the consolidated services of several oil companies on the North Slope of Alaska. That idea germinated over time and was cultivated in a moment of great change in Alaska's philanthropic and corporate landscape. Foraker was launched under the United Way umbrella in January of 2001 with the clear intent to serve all Alaska nonprofits and tribes by building their internal capacity and promoting philanthropy. Lori, thank you for joining us today at Senate Labor and Commerce. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Good afternoon, everyone. Chair Bjorkman and committee members. For the record, my name is Lori Wolf. I am the president and CEO of the Foraker Group and a born and raised Alaskan. I am so grateful for the invitation to speak with you today about on behalf of Alaska's nonprofits. And thank you for such a wonderful introduction to Foraker. That was so kind. As a trusted voice within the state and around the country in all three sectors, private, nonprofit, and government over the last 20 years, today, my plan is to share an overview of the nonprofit sector in Alaska based on the full set of data that we have on employment, which is 2020. Then I'll share some specific examples of how the great resignation in the workforce and the overall lack of workforce in our nonprofits and in-state agencies has impacted the health, safety, and well-being of Alaskans. And then finally, I will accept your offer by this committee to offer a few significant concrete action steps for consideration. I do believe I'm getting some support in the room with a slide deck, which I can't see. So this will be extra fun for all of us. And so if you would please advance to the slide that says an overview of the nonprofit sector with an employment lens, that would be great. And we'll dive in from there.
Very good. Thank you, Lori. Would you prefer the committee keep the questions till the end, or should we ask questions as we go throughout the presentation?
I guess I could go whichever way the committee prefers, either way.
Okay.
I do have prepared remarks that will take probably about a half an hour or so if we go nice and slow, but I'm happy to pause at any moment.
That sounds great. Thank you. So folks can feel free to ask questions as we go or wait until the end. Please continue with your presentation.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you so much. So let's dive in and look at nonprofits with an employment lens. The next slide. Data on Alaska's nonprofits is hard to compile, especially when it comes to the workforce. In Alaska, we don't track our employment by sector, so there are countless steps to get us the data that I will present today. And for this reason, we only capture this full set of data every 3 years. I am grateful to the Department of Labor, specifically Corrine Weibold, for her work with us, and to the Center for Economic Development at the University of Alaska Anchorage for their deep analysis of this data. Together, we were able to provide this comprehensive look at Alaska's nonprofits. The full report is available for download on our website, and many of you have received a printed version from our team when we were in the Capitol last week. Next slide. For those interested in a deeper dive at any time, there is an addition to this report that's an interactive map on our website with where more specifics on each census region of the state can be found. I encourage you all to go in there and click around. Next slide.
We're going to take just a brief video. One second. We're back on the record. Lori, I apologize for the pause there. We just wanted to make sure we were at the correct place in the slide deck. So if you could just call out the slide that you're on, and then we'll make sure that we are on the right slide in the room, and we will continue.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. We are on the slide that is entitled, Alaska's Nonprofits Are Currently Contributing to the Alaska's Economy in Six Ways. It is slide number 6 in your deck. All right. Are we on track?
Yes, ma'am.
Great. So since many of you have seen the full report, you know that we cover these 6 ways that Alaska's nonprofits are contributing to Alaska's economy. Today, I'll only be selecting a few points as they relate to the impact of employment. If other committees in the House or Senate are interested in the data, we can provide that in its full context. Many Alaskans might be surprised to think of nonprofits in the ways that are articulated on your screen and in your handouts. All too often, we hear that we should have less nonprofits and no financial relationship with them. But in Alaska, that would be a big mistake for many reasons, including the extreme costs that government would pay to provide services or the complete loss of those services impacting our health and quality of life. Next slide. To further understand the role nonprofits play in our state, we often point out that because we don't have a county system of government in Alaska, our nonprofits play the role alongside and in partnership with federal, state, local, and tribal governments. In fact, it would be highly improbable for any Alaskans to move through their day without using the services of a nonprofit. For some of us, even the act of turning on our lights could start the day powered by a nonprofit. For others, you might listen to public radio, drop your child off at a nonprofit daycare or school, ensure your elder is safe and supported, recreate on trails maintained by nonprofits, attend a religious service, or work for a nonprofit alongside 38,000 other nonprofit employees in the state. Or perhaps you're part of the professional associations that are the backbone to every industry in our state. To be more specific, Alaska's nonprofits are providing essential services like medical care, housing, and utilities. They also bring us joy and purpose through art, religious and cultural expression, education, and recreation. They ensure our quality of life, sustain our way of life, and attract employees to our state. In short, nonprofits are caring for our people, our pets, and our planet to foster healthier and more prosperous communities. I invite everyone listening to this session to look around your community and notice how often your life is enriched by a nonprofit. Together, we make Alaska work. Next slide. So let's get this question right out of the way. How many nonprofits are there in Alaska? While the number is interesting, it does not tell the whole story. It is a tempting distraction as we debate how many we have rather than their impact on our community. But to be sure, we have 5,620 nonprofits activated in our state. But in fact, there are 29 different types of nonprofits regulated by the IRS. And in Alaska, they represent a wide variety of missions that provide public service and are true contributors to Alaska's quality of life, our health, and our economy today and well into the future. When most people think about nonprofits, they focus on the 501c3s or charitable nonprofits with missions like health, arts, conservation, education, religion, and many others. While that is the majority at 78%, those are the charitable ones, it's important to note that the other types of nonprofits are important contributors to our economy. Next slide. So nonprofits are major economic drivers. As I pivot to talking about the workforce, it's important to remember that the majority of the nonprofits I just presented exist without staff and on volunteer labor alone. This is not a preferred state of being for those organizations, but they simply do not have the financial resources to employ people. But when we can, like all businesses, we know that stability comes with the consistent ability to compensate our staff and provide a healthy workplace. So as I look at the nonprofits that are employing Alaskans, what the data tells us clearly is that nonprofits are a significant source of Alaska jobs. We often lose sight of the scale of our impact because nonprofits are not considered to be a single industry. Specifically, when the state tracks jobs, it classifies them by industries, oil and gas, tourism, healthcare, et cetera, not by the sector where the work originates, nonprofits, government, or private sector. In fact, what makes Alaska's workforce unique is that all three sectors are integrated in all of our state's industries. Next slide. Using the same economic modeling as other major industries in our state, we know that in 2020, the nonprofit sector directly employed 38,105 Alaskans. Counting indirect and induced effects, nonprofits are responsible for sustaining just over 57,900 jobs in the state. And a vibrant nonprofit community helps generate jobs both directly and indirectly. When nonprofits spend money on supplies, services, or payroll, it circulates around the state, creating more jobs and a stronger economy. Together, these jobs translate into just over $4 billion in total income generated by the nonprofit sector. Next slide. Again, based on the same economic modeling used in Alaska's oil and gas, fisheries, and other tourism industries, when indirect and induced jobs are considered for all industries, the nonprofit sector is the third largest industry in Alaska. Additionally, interesting to note is that nearly a quarter of non-government jobs are tied to nonprofits through indirect and induced effects. Next slide. Another way to understand the role our jobs play in Alaska's major industries is to look at our role as a backbone and frontline workers. From associations engaging in the public policy process to economic development agencies promoting job opportunities, nonprofits contribute to the vitality of commercial enterprises. For the business community, nonprofits are often a vehicle for collaboration to improve the business climate, or pursue shared objectives like visitor marketing. In other cases, the major players in an industry are the nonprofits themselves, such as hospitals, credit unions, and the state's largest electric utilities. Alaska's seized food industry hosts unique nonprofit entities like the CDQ groups that generate revenue for community investments and aquaculture or associations that enhance salmon runs. These are all nonprofits. Next slide. One way to understand the impact of Alaska's nonprofits are to look at how we deliver essential services in Alaska. Every day, Alaska's nonprofits deliver efficient and effective services to all Alaskans as a predictable and stable partner to government. Again, without a county system of government, Alaska's unique structure means that in urban and particularly in rural areas, nonprofits deliver a variety of public services like water and sanitation, fire service, utilities, libraries, and public transportation. Our partnerships create a social safety net that strengthens the fabric of Alaska's communities. A great example is the over 40 communities that depend on nonprofit volunteer fire departments. With limited budgets, small staff crews, and a duty to protect the public, these organizations embody thrift and resourcefulness. Also, roughly 47 nonprofit libraries operate across Alaska to ensure that access to information and lifelong learning is available across generations. Our electric cooperatives present yet another example. Roughly 75% of Alaskans receive their power from a nonprofit cooperative utility. These organizations also account for a majority of utility employment. These are just a few of the ways nonprofits work closely with government, and in Alaska, that's just business as usual. Next slide. Nonprofits are important to regional economies, too. Nationwide, nonprofits employ 10% of the workforce. In Alaska, nonprofits employ roughly 13% of the workforce. However, in some rural areas, nonprofits are responsible for up to 40% of direct employment. In at least six of Alaska's 30 boroughs and census areas, nonprofits provide 20% or more of all employment. This is largely because of our tribal health system, which is run by nonprofits and is often the largest employer in the area. Next slide. It should be no surprise that healthcare and social services are the largest employers, as it is impossible to help people without the employees to do the work. I know you recently heard from Jared Kosin of the Alaska Hospital and Nursing Home Association on the state of the workforce in that area, and I hope you are planning to invite many other experts to speak to you about the specifics of employment in the vast area of human services, from babies to elders. I would like to note that it was never clearer than in 2020 and 2021, when healthcare and human service nonprofits were the first responders to the pandemic, how grateful we should all be for Alaska's workers who provided leadership, extreme adaptability, and critical care for Alaskans. Importantly, as a reminder, that if you don't see a topic represented in this chart, it is that they employ less than 300 positions, which is the vast majority of our nonprofits, or often they are running on volunteer power, for better or worse, or, like childcare, it lives not only in nonprofit space, but also in for-profit space and government space and many other spaces. One more point. Next slide. One more point from our study that I would like to make before moving to the specific realities that we face today is how nonprofits are funded. There is a lot of myths to bust in this space, and we can't talk about workforce without talking about budgets. The full cost of employment and nonprofit budgets, just like government and for-profit industry, are our largest drivers in our budget. What is true is that nonprofits generate revenue from a variety of sources, including grants and contracts, from many layers of government. What is also true is that many of those sources were challenged before the pandemic, and then were turned upside down in the pandemic and continue to be greatly hindered by the prompt payment challenges, shifts in philanthropy, and workforce shortages. What is also true is that as nonprofits seek financial resiliency, each one will make a strategic decision whether to focus predominantly on mission-based revenue. On mission-based revenue. Mission-based earned income or charitable contributions, and every dollar, including those from grants and contracts from the state and federal government, are leveraged to raise more money for more mission. Next slide. Now we'll turn to some specific examples impacting nonprofits. Now that we have a broad understanding of the landscape, I want to share some specific examples with you that I have received from some of the nonprofit partners in just the last few days. Trust me when I share that these examples only scratch the surface of a much deeper set of issues that are hampering our ability to attract and retain the workforce we need to serve the health, safety, and well-being of Alaskans. And the ripple of these real-world challenges only illustrate the work ahead of us. Also, let me be clear, these problems stretch far beyond this administration, and some of them are decades in the making. But the realities of the pandemic shifts in our workforce, the outmigration of Alaskans, and the state of our economy create a clear opportunity to fix these issues now. We simply cannot wait another year or another decade. Let me also personally say thank you to the administrative staff, both in nonprofits and in state government, absorbing so many of these challenges that I'll talk about today. I see such hard workers doing their best under the most challenging conditions. Next slide. So first, we'll talk about the reality of the pandemic effect. To be sure, nonprofits felt the effects of the pandemic differently depending on a variety of factors. While the demand on health and human service organizations increased almost overnight, many other organizations had to adapt to providing services with their physical doors closed. And yet nonprofits nimbly adapted to meet the needs of Alaskans, while at the same time enduring the economic hardships of the pandemic economy. While we have seen the health emergency shift, we know we will face the economic and workforce impacts for many, many more years as we adapt to the ever-changing health precautions, staffing shifts amidst the great resignation and reshuffle, unexpected costs in the lagging supply chain, waning volunteerism, and uncertain funding sources. As every nonprofit faces rebuilding their business models in this economy, they do so knowing that their ability to recover is part of building the foundation for a strong economy for all Alaska. Perhaps there is no more perfect example of this impact of the pandemic than its role in our workforce, than the recognition that childcare needs to be addressed across our state. The bottom line, nonprofits are still trying to recover in the face of increased demand, loss of workers and volunteers, and deep shifts in funding. Next slide. The reality of delayed payments. Ensuring that nonprofits are paid promptly for the work they are doing for the state, whether through grants, contracts, or Medicaid reimbursement, is essential in our ability to attract and retain employees. Unreliable cash flow not only creates undue stress and burnout on state and nonprofit employees, but it can also create life and death consequences when we are not able to meet the needs of those we serve. The additional weight of not paying for food or medical expenses for those in greatest need only creates more dire consequences for people, nonprofits, and local governments. Today, I plan to share two stories, one from the Tundra Women's Coalition in Bethel and one from the Kodiak Senior Center, that shows us some of the ripple effects when payments are not received on time. Eileen Arnold with TWC notes the agency, quote, is a cash poor agency in a cash poor community in a cash poor region. She says state funds, both directly and indirectly, are supposed to advance to an agency a quarter's worth of general funds and reimburse monthly for federal funds to keep the doors open. She goes on to note, the advances are almost never advances. First quarter starts July 1, the advance came on August 2nd, and the third quarter starts January 1, and the advance came on the 4th. What happens then is, quote, I have to spend a lot of time calling every vendor I can, asking them if they can wait on payment. Because this is a small town, and I know people that that's possible, though humiliating, because I cannot pay people or taxes or utilities. I actually did consider holding payroll for our staff because we simply didn't have the cash. But we ended up getting some at the end of the end of the year donations and reimbursements from some other agencies where we were sub-awardees, and that let us scrape through. It's a lot of effort, she says, for me and my finance staff. We should be able to depend on prompt payment instead of spending time calling vendors and asking them to go without payment so we can stay afloat. Pat Branson with the Kodiak Senior Center also shares their payment woes. Quarter one grant payments starting in July were received October 3rd, after Q1 had ended. We had to show expenses in order to complete our quarter one reports, which triggers our quarter two payments, though we had not received any revenue to reflect those expenses. The Kodiak Senior Center did not receive quarter two grant payments until November 4th and December 2nd. In order to complete our second quarter reports, we had to expend those funds received on December 2nd by December 31st. Our agency has funds set aside, thank goodness, she says. Otherwise, we would not have been able to meet payroll or deliver services to those 60 and older on Kodiak Island. I am not sure how other agencies got through with this payment glitch, she notes. These examples are current, but they are not new, and they are not unique to Alaska. We are hearing about prompt payment issues across many states as everyone struggles with a workforce shortage. That said, our challenge is exacerbated by an outdated and way overdue IT overhaul and an update to the way that we code and process payments. The bottom line to this challenge, the significant and substantial delays by the state in payments of grants and contracts is hurting people, workers, and our economy. All of these challenges will take more people in both the state and nonprofits to solve. Next slide. The reality of underfunding and cuts. An example of many is from our colleagues at Head Start, who currently serve over 2,600 children in over 100 Alaska communities. Mark Lackey shares that they have a clear workforce crisis coupled with their inability to serve more children in the state. Part of this story for them is the lack of a full match from the state, which they could leverage with other funds to turn into better wages and benefits, which in turn means more children receive care, which in turn means more parents can go to work. The bottom line here, the cuts and or flat funding over the last decade has lessened our ability to serve Alaskans in need, compete in the workforce for quality staff, and lessens our ability to leverage every dollar lost with other funding. The reality of vacant positions. Next slide. The great resignation and reshuffle is not reserved for one sector or one place. It is currently a universal truth in every workplace. The bottom line, there are simply not enough qualified workers to do the work, causing services to close and creating great stress on those who stay. I know you have many examples from many state agencies where we hear the vacancy rate for your administrative staff who are engaging with nonprofits daily are greatly under-resourced. We can see a visual reminder ourselves on our own free job board for nonprofits that is regularly updated every day. I wanted to share a few other examples of the health and safety consequences of a lack of nonprofit staff is having on Alaskans. Hope Community Resources shares their situation, which they say echoes many of the other service providers within the Alaska Association on Developmental Disabilities Network. They say HOPE has closed and consolidated 8 assisted living homes over the past year, a significant factor being lack of staffing, limiting residential choices for residents. HOPE values choice in its mission, they say, but this is significantly reduced without adequate staffing. People seeking HOPE services have to wait or seek support elsewhere, so intake processes are delayed or referred to other providers. 1 in 3 people authorized and funded to receive services in natural homes or their own apartment do not have staff due to shortages. Mandatory requirements for HOPE to staff licensed assisted living homes become a priority. These families are experiencing extra stress and risk of crisis, but do not choose to move to another provider because the same workforce shortages is affecting them. The shortage is also exacerbated by a loss of trained employees to provide relief or cover vacations, increasing strain and burnout on remaining employees. Additionally, overtime costs have soared to cover essential shifts in a 24/7 residential environment. Hope's annual budget for overtime has been exceeded in less than 6 months, further increasing burnout risk. The Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, which covers 22 agencies, have common themes to impacting their ability to provide services. Inability to compete in the marketplace to both retain and recruit employees, lack of staffing to achieve safety components of their missions, which run 24/7, 365 days a year. One program said, "We have a huge workforce shortage here that's really impacted our agency. We had to close our child care assistance program last year due to lack of staff and not being able to hire anyone to take those positions. We are currently facing the potential of closing our transitional housing facility that has been in operation for over 40 years. Another program said, quote, "All of our current staff who are hired to do prevention work in our community are covering shelter shifts because we do not have enough advocates to cover the 24/7 shift necessary to ensure safety. Everyone is working overtime and they are getting tired." Another program reported, "We have to reduce the number of individuals we can assist due to our low staffing levels. The impact is that victims who have come to us for emergency shelter are being turned away because of reduced capacity." Another area they reported seeing impacts due to workforce shortage is on the overall system in place to protect and provide services to those victimized. Across the board, there is a shortage of BPSOs, a shortage of troopers, and many medical facilities do not have a sexual assault nurse examiner to work with sexual abuse victims. These are sobering stories, and they are just a few of the many. But we are not here just to share with you all of the challenges. We were invited to share with you some solutions. I'd like to turn to that now, if we can go to the next slide. While we don't know all of the solutions, there are some that will clearly have an immediate and a long-term impact. All of them are within the purview of the state to take the lead, and all of them will be best when we lock arms to arms and do the work together. Next slide. Our call to action, the handwriting was on the wall in 2020, and truly before that, it had been building for a long time. Back in 2020, we wrote in our economic report about the need to address staffing shortages and adjust grant and contracts for inflation and to be able to compensate to compete better in the marketplace for scarce employees and to do vastly more work than we had ever been doing before the pandemic. Back then, I was optimistic that the nonprofits could do what they could to adjust by adjusting their business models, creating collaborations, and expanding services where needed. But those things can't happen well without some additional work that they cannot and should not do alone. So the next slide proposes, and we'll stay there for a little while here, I'm going to propose five concrete action steps that the state can take. The first is prioritize prompt payments. If only if we're that easy. We know this is both a workforce capacity issue and a technology problem, as well as a process issue. Other states are seeking workable prompt payment solutions, and Alaska can lead the way if we put our attention to it. There are good ideas both from within the state departments and from leaders in our sector. Let's learn from each other and from other states how to do it right in Alaska. Our next suggestion, overhaul the state's IT system. In recent legislative hearings, the woes of the state's outdated and overburdened technology system has become a true source of many woes. More than a decade ago, we understand there was an effort to update, streamline, and network the systems for efficiency and effectiveness, but these goals were never completed, and it is hurting everyone. The cyber attack only made the bad worse. In addition to hindering prompt payment to people, nonprofits, and others, it is also continuing to hinder the background check system, which is a core system in our ability to hire workers in all health and human service and childcare jobs. We must move away from the manual, slow processes and significantly overhaul the IT system so that we can process the staff we all seek. Concrete solutions have been offered in the area of the background checks by the Alaska Mental Health Trust, the Alaska Association for Developmental Disabilities, and others. and they should be considered as a legislative and or regulatory fix when it comes to the background checks. We know that the state can access many other experts to guide your way in overhauling the whole system. We encourage you to do so. The next suggestion, recognize the essential workforce. If the work is essential, so must be the worker. We are not going to find a set of workable solutions to our workforce challenges until we can all offer a living wage, affordable health care, and other benefits. In addition, we must see, recognize, and thank the workers we do have for doing an extremely hard job day in and day out. Nonprofits have never been fully staffed administratively because we don't have enough unrestricted cash to pay for it. The state's workforce also has clearly suffered significant cuts in vacant administrative jobs for longer than I can remember. One argument to cutting was that those jobs were vacant, but that only means we are now years into overpressure and overworked people doing more with less. We can see the impact in so many issues related to the lack of payments in SNAP and the inability to process Medicaid and other grant payments on time. This, coupled with a piecemealed IT system, is hurting workers and hurting Alaskans. We can fix this problem by asking each department about their true administrative needs to get the work done and build our state budget from this stable place. Next, addressing the complex factors hindering the workforce. The recent Anchorage Economic Development Report lays out this problem well, but for the whole state. Quote, the city has struggled with several factors that contribute to workforce availability and overall quality of life. High housing costs, low availability of childcare services, and uncertainty surrounding K through 12 education funding being the three of the most prominent in 2022, end quote. There are no single solutions to our workforce woes. The solutions lie in our willingness to be brave enough to see and meet the complexity of the challenge together. And we encourage you to do that. And finally, my final request today, invite your nonprofit partners to the table. We are diverse in our experiences and our skills. We are on the ground within Alaska's communities. We are a resource and we are your partners. Yes, we might share more problems, but we will come with solutions. Even as we were getting ready for today, I heard more great ideas about regulatory reforms, rate reviews, process overhauls, and new collaborations to leverage both people and money to better serve Alaskans. My colleagues from across the state have been living these challenges for a long time, and they come with solutions. We're eager to work with you to ensure nonprofits don't go out of business or fail to serve Alaskans. Invite them in. We are stronger when we work together. So last slide, we have covered a lot of ground. There are clear challenges and there are concrete action steps we can take, and we'd like to take them together. My message today is that nonprofits want what you want, a strong economy and a stable workforce. We know our safety net is thin, our resources are short, and the tendency to cut instead of invest is high. But we must change that story if we want Alaska's economy to thrive. We are ready, on behalf of 4-Acre and all the nonprofits in our state, we are ready to work on a plan with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your presentation today, Lori. Are there questions from members of the committee? Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Laura, you used a phrase that I found interesting, waning volunteerism. And I was wondering, you know, my sense of my generation, millennials, is that we volunteer quite a lot, or at least we used to before some of us started having kids, and that probably put a damper on it a little bit. But have your nonprofit partners sort of, do they have any explanation of why that might be the case, why people tend to volunteer less now than they might have in the past?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, that's a wonderful question and a hard one as well. Let me just say that the last time there was good data about volunteerism in Alaska at a national level, Alaska ranked fourth in volunteerism. So Alaskans know how to help each other. We're really good at it. And we do it often and we do it well. But that said, what we're hearing and seeing is that very much like the great reshuffle in the workforce, we're seeing a reshuffle in our volunteerism. We're seeing people who are taking stock of the deeper commitments that they're making to nonprofits through board service and other kind of longer term commitments, and really taking stock about how they want to spend their time. So Foraker has some initiatives underway right now, including our Alaska Board Match site, to encourage more Alaskans to serve on our boards. But we certainly are seeing some of the effects of the pandemic take hold in our volunteer pool. I think it's also maybe helpful to just recognize that many of our volunteer programs across our state had to shut down during the pandemic in the name of public health. And so what many of our nonprofits are facing is having to try to restart those programs, but without the resources and the staffing to do it. Volunteer programs don't magically happen. They happen because people are organizing them. So we have to have the people to organize more people. So there is a ripple effect that's happened as a result of the pandemic.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Lori. Excellent overview of the questions I had. You already answered them. To dovetail into Senator Dunbar's question, do you think the 10-year out migration of 8,800 people a year has had anything to do with the volunteerism?
Through the chair, I think that's an amazing question. I would love to see the data on that. I have some anecdotal moments in my life in the last couple of years that maybe make me want to say maybe. Because so many of our board meetings and other opportunities have gone virtual, lots of Alaskans who are truly committed to the organizations that they were committed to are still serving on those boards. They're still doing what they can. They're just not doing it from here. So I'm not sure that I would say there's a correlation, but I would love to see a study that tried to figure that out. Of course, volunteerism is local as well. So as soon as those folks get planted wherever they've moved to, my guess is they'll let go of their Alaska connections and make their new connections. But at least in the interim, as they're resettling, my guess is they're not letting go too quickly. It's a great question, though.
Thank you. Are there other questions from members of the committee? I have a few. Once again, thank you very much for coming and talking to us today, Lori. Really appreciate it. Toward the beginning of your presentation, through slides about 7 through 9, you talked about the value that nonprofits have in their partnership with specifically our state and local governments here in Alaska. Could you talk about why, with maybe some specifics, if you can, about how nonprofits save government money?
How long do we have, Mr. Chairman? it's a great question. There are so many examples. Again, I'll just come back to the point around our lack of county system of government. So Alaska just does it differently from day one. In terms of how nonprofits are partnering with both local governments and state and federal governments to deliver services. I think our volunteer fire departments are an excellent example that I provided. When we, in our report prior to this one, we actually calculated how much money the state was saving every time they invested in a volunteer fire department. And I'm sorry, I can't come up with the number off the top of my head, but we do have it, and I'd be happy to follow up with you and provide that. We also know that the independent living, nonprofit organizations that focus on independent living have also done their math and calculated how much money they save the state by keeping people in their homes and creating independent living supportive systems rather than having them come into state run facilities like the Pioneer Home or other places. So there are, we had a call to action a handful of years ago to nonprofits that we called it do the math and really figure out how much money are we really saving the state. So lots of our organizations have taken up that call, and we would be happy to provide that data for you. But I think there's so many examples where sometimes, right, the nonprofits are doing it better, cheaper, faster, because we're on the ground in community working hand in hand with those we serve.
Very good. Thank you for that. And certainly when I answer the question for myself and for some others about why nonprofits, that is part of the answer, is that nonprofits provide service and value that is very close to the people, and they provide those services that otherwise it would take the government thousands, if not hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars more to provide a substitute service that nonprofits can do for much less.
And Mr. Chairman, I might also just add that we can also leverage every dollar we receive. So every dollar the state invests is a dollar we can leverage against private philanthropy and our earned income sources. You saw in that chart I provided about how money comes to our nonprofits, which for many I think is a surprise. But so every dollar is a leverage dollar. And I think this is an important point, especially if we start talking about cuts. Or not meeting matches or other opportunities there, we always have to ask the question of what are we not able to do in terms of leverage?
And when you use that term leverage, you're meaning matched contributions, right?
Yes, meeting matches, but even that ability to, you know, if the state grant or contract is, you know, creating some stability in the organization, then that means, like we heard from our friends in Tundra Women's Coalition, right? Then they're not spending their energy working on that. They're spending their energy raising money in other places, doing other things, right? So the stability that the partnership with the state has is can't be overstated.
Thank you. Senator Gray Jackson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Lori, thank you so much for your presentation. But when you think about it, burnout, frustration with employees results in anxiety, which is a mental health issue. And so I'm wondering just how much does this play a part in the stability of nonprofits and the workforce? Thank you.
Through the chair, a wonderful question and a sobering one at that. And I listened to the testimony about the state employees who were working on the front lines of trying to get SNAP payments out the door, and you know, my heart hurt for them. I think they're working so hard and, in the face of quite a lot of animosity it has to be taking a toll. So I wouldn't answer that question just about nonprofit employees. I would think about your own state employees as well in this conversation. But absolutely, I think, we are a helping profession, many of us, we feel deeply the work that we do every day. And I think, as an employer, I employ 22 people, and I am always thinking about the well-being of my team and thinking about what do they need to not just do their jobs, but really about their full wellness. It's an important question. I don't think we have enough resources to meet everyone's needs.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. Lori, I have a question concerning childcare. You and many others across the state have brought up this need. The Alaska Chamber was here last week lobbying, and they mentioned that one of their priorities was childcare. And I encourage all of those who kind of have concerns about this very widespread challenge to bring forward some solutions. With the nonprofit sector and certainly in your work, what do you see as a solution to the child care issue that we face now?
Mr. Chairman, I think it's a wonderful question. I'll say first, as now a mom of a teenager, but I'm a working mom and I needed child care. And I remember a statistic back then that said, there were 14,000 spots in Anchorage for 28,000 kids. And my kid's a little grown up now. She doesn't need childcare, but I remember thinking, like, how is that possible? Right. So we started, and we're fortunate in Anchorage and in this, in most urban centers, there is even childcare available at all. So I just want to say, I'm grateful that so many are picking up this conversation and talking about its urgency. And let's be clear that Alaska has never had enough childcare to meet the needs of our children since for as long as I can remember. So I think we have an exacerbated problem because of the pandemic. And certainly the workforce shortage, you know, is a lot of people who cannot find affordable childcare or childcare at all. I am not a childcare expert. What I do know is that there are childcare experts in our state, and they have a lot of ideas, and I would encourage you to invite them to the table. I think childcare is an interesting conversation for us as well, and I would find an interesting conversation for this committee because it is one of those services that we have in our state that is delivered by every sector. So government is involved through Head Start, partnership with nonprofits and government. Our tribes, our local, you know, mom and pop in home care, major corporations, like you name it, and there is an opportunity to provide some amount of childcare. So I do think it the complexity really warrants an expert, which I am not. But there are, thankfully, lots of really great people in our state who do have concrete solutions.
Very good. Certainly, I appreciate that sentiment, and I appreciate hearing from those experts about concrete solutions that we can take action on here with all of our colleagues in the legislature and the administration. To that end, when we talk about maybe part of that issue is a licensing issue within social services and health, or other things in regards to delayed payments even, what are concrete solutions that you see? Where are the choke points in the delayed payments that you spoke about in your presentation? How can we help?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I think we are talking about process. I think we're talking about procurement process. I think we're talking about the expertise within departments making sure that expertise makes it in and crosses into the Department of Administration, which is where things are checks are getting cut. And so, you know, making sure that your teams are connected, that there are IT systems to support those connections. There are some regulatory fix. There's some procurement process fix. There's certainly lots of calls for my colleagues around rate fix. There are a number of concrete suggestions from a variety of people where they can pinpoint some of the challenges. I will say those challenges primarily lie in process, technology, and lack of people. There are just simply not enough people in the state system to do the processing. So even if the technology worked, which it doesn't, and even if the process was streamlined, which it's not, you have a people problem. You don't have enough of them, and they are overworked, and I am afraid overburdened with these issues. So I don't pretend to know how the state should fix that issue, but I can see clearly that there are things to fix.
Okay, Lori. So I guess this could serve as an all call to all interested parties.
Mr. Chairman, I would invite you to, you know, I think your commissioners in each department could probably offer you, they can see it. I know they can see it. And I would invite them tell you what they can see and how they think they could fix it, really from the administrative staffing space. And then our nonprofits can also come with suggestions as well around the regulatory changes that we think might help.
We look forward to hearing those suggestions for specific things that we can do to help. Absolutely. One final question from me. You mentioned when you were talking about slide 24 and workers needed to help with human services and those type of folks. How can the state facilitate creation of more workers to help in the human service space?
So in the nonprofit human service space or the state side, Mr. Chairman?
Anything specifically that we can do other than kind of the big broad things that we've talked about so far?
Well, if I had a magic wand, you would, the state could adjust existing grants and contracts to match inflation. That would be remarkable. I don't think my magic wand is going to let me do that. And Senator Bishop probably with finance would probably have something to say to me about that. But I do think we have to have a real conversation about how many workers does it take to do the work? And again, I think we are building budgets on without those numbers. We're building budgets both at the state, but also inside our nonprofits. Our nonprofits have never been fully administratively staffed because we can't afford it. And I fear that that is happening in the state as well. So I think we have to tell the whole truth about what it really costs to do the work. And then we can make decisions and choices from there. But I think what happens often is we don't do that.
Very good. Senator Bishop and then Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Lori, you just, when you're reading my mail, you must have been at finance this morning, but I concur with you, and I'll just, it's just an editorial comment on myself, but you know, we've got a couple of bills, I believe, in the building going right now. I think they've had a first hearing last week. People talk about a spending cap. And before my own personal opinion, before I'll vote for any spending cap, we got to come to terms of what the base budget really is. Because until you do that, in my opinion, you're putting yourself in a hole if you don't come to grips on what the base budget truly is. And so, thank you.
Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Lori, you have offered us suggestions on page, 31? And five suggestions. And the thought process down is how do we go about implementing at least some of the suggestions, and I'm saying that to my colleagues here and the entire legislature, frankly. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions? Senator Dunbar.
Just a real quick one. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going off of what Senator Gray Jackson just said in our prior conversation, when you talk about prioritizing prompt payment, where, you know, there are a variety of nonprofits that work with a variety of different organizations and state agencies. Is the holdup usually at that relevant state agency, say the health department or even like the Department of Corrections or something like that? Or is it all flow through the Department of Administration? Or I should say, like, what percent would you estimate flows through the Department of Administration? Because if that's the case, then the Department of Administration is really one we need to have this conversation with in pretty frank terms.
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, that's a wonderful question as well. And I, as something that I've been trying to unpack myself, as you know, I was in the Capitol last week and trying to get to the heart of the matter as well. And the reality, I don't know if you can see me very well, but the reality is that everyone was sending me in a different direction. I think that what we know on the front side of the equation is who the agency is that we have the grant and contract with in any particular nonprofit. What we don't know is the process that it goes through on the backside. I think what is, so I don't know how many things flow through the Department of Administration versus directly, but I think it's based on the conversations I had last week. I think that's a really important question to ask and to get to the bottom of. I think it seems quite siloed in terms of who knows about which processes are working and not working, which is why I made that comment about inviting all of the commissioners to the table, because I think it could be different in each department. What I'm basically saying here is Alaska does not have a streamlined one-stop process. We have a lot of processes that have been developed over the years. And I think if I go to the Department of Transportation, it's a different process than if I go to the Department of Health and Human Services. I'm sorry, that's not what it's called now, et cetera. You know, so I do think you have a challenge in the Department of Administration, not of its own making, but of decades of making. And again, it's coupled with, a very antiquated IT system, which, you know, anyone can just listen to that snap hearing and feel that pain. But that is kind of happening more than just in that area. So I think that's a good question. I also, if I might go back to another question about, you know, what do we do about our essential workers and our workforce? And I will come back to the Alaska challenge of access to healthcare. Like healthcare in the state is incredibly expensive and very difficult to access. So in addition to a living wage, which many of our essential workers don't receive, they are also not accessing benefits or healthcare. And I know this is a conversation that the state is having around state employees and retirements and benefits, but you should also know that these are issues that we face in the nonprofit space as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions for Ms. Wolf? Thank you very much for joining us today, Lori, at Senate Labor and Commerce. We really appreciate you being here, and we'll be reaching out to you further with more questions for suggestions, as well as how to execute those suggestions that you provided us today. And we'll be looking forward to talking with many of your partners in the nonprofit space and human service space about what it is that we can do with regulation change or execution in these processes to make things work better for working families all across Alaska. So thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. The committee will have no further meetings this week, but please stay tuned to BASIS for updates to our schedule. As there is no further business to come before the committee today, this meeting is adjourned at 2:35 p.m.